Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Jaya Kumar, and Abyaz Karim. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. Coming just after difficult budget deliberations last month, Council considered a motion brought forward by Councillor Paul Shaves to look into implementing non-Kingston resident user fees for city facilities and services. The motion cites budget constraints and significant growth pressures, and argues for the importance of residents having equitable and prioritized access to city-owned facilities and services supported by their property taxes. Options suggested in the motion included differential pricing structures for non-residents, priority registration windows for Kingston residents for recreational programs, facility bookings, and other high-demand services, and resident-only access periods or capacity allocations for specific city-owned facilities. Loyalist was the only neighboring municipality explicitly identified in discussion as charging non-resident user fees. Councillor Connie Glenn was the first to bring up concerns with the idea.
You know, I understand the fiscal concerns that we are facing. I mean, we just went through a really difficult budget challenge. But I also am concerned about, to some degree, the neighborliness, if you will put it that way. I'm looking at what's happening in the broader context out here. We've just gone through a tariff scare, and hopefully it stays a scare. But it almost seems a little bit like this, that we're talking about our neighbors next door. And my concern with this motion has to do with that we maintain good relationships, because we don't know when we're going to have to rely on our neighbors for support on something. So I'm okay with having a look at things, but I just want to make sure that we don't overstep in how we approach this, and that we give consideration to the mutual support that we need to have in our region. So I'm going to leave it at that. I just find myself discomforted by the fact that we're bringing this kind of emotion.
Councillor Ryan Bohm brought up similar worries, also referencing the recent threats of tariffs from the United States.
My one concern here is just in light of sort of what's going on with the states right now is, you know, are we going to start a resident, non-resident user fee war with all our neighbors, and all of a sudden everybody's trying to outdo each other, and it just becomes this, you know, leapfrog effect where everybody's constantly raising their fees for non-residents.
Councillor Jeff McLaren also took issue with the idea, citing larger value-based concerns.
I'm very, very much against the very principle that this represents. We are setting up discriminatory walls. And it seems that other municipalities have also done that already. And we are going to just encourage this. It seems to be getting more. And where does it stop? Are we going to block everybody at some point because they're not paying taxes here? That doesn't seem to be part of the spirit of not discriminate against place of origin. We do have that as one of the principles that we live on in this country. And let's consider what we're doing here. We're actually going to create two tiers of citizenship or residency based on where you live. That doesn't seem right. There's something very wrong about that. Public amenities should be public, and equally so. There are lots of parks in Kingston that I don't visit, but I still pay taxes to fund that. Do we want to have the idea that, hey, if we don't use a particular amenity, I don't want to pay for it? This seems to me that we're being mean and petty and discriminatory.
Councillor Jimmy Hassan brought up his personal experience accessing local facilities, also arguing that Kingston should prioritize its taxpayers.
I remember that when me and my wife was waking up 4 o'clock, get into the line at the YMCA for the swimming lessons. And we are a taxpayer from 2005 since I bought my first house. And we are still paying taxes, and I see the still same situation from the Kingston resident. The long lines, and you know, they have to wake up early, and then still, it's not that we are opposing on them and forcing them to do that, but it's a lack of availability because the other people, other non-resident also in standing up in the line probably in front of them. And about the tariff, you know, we are not trading anything with them. So we are just offering them facilities here. When you use Frontenac transportation, you pay for them. We use their facility for ambulance, we pay for it. Or they pay to us too. It's no such a tariff thing. It's not terrible things. Asking a fair share to maintain the cost of it. They are welcome to use anytime. They can get into the line with our resident, but they have to pay a little bit more because our taxpayer paying the taxes to use the services from the city, and they deserve better and first.
After hearing from councillors, Mayor Brian Patterson made a final statement and requested that council wait for him to discuss the issue with other mayors.
I think this is about fairness. And you can be neighborly and talk about fairness, right? So the last couple of years, the mayors of all of our neighboring municipalities have been meeting. And it's been good discussions. And you know what we talk about? We talk about, are there ways that we may need to work together so that not every municipality is investing in the same thing? That maybe there are ways that we can partner and we can create, for example, recreational facilities that maybe can be shared. This, in my view, is just part of that discussion. We're just getting some information about potential possibilities about, okay, if we want to finance new pools or new arenas in the future that are very expensive or other facilities, that we can have those discussions to say, okay, well, there are different ways that, you know, if Kingston was to take the lead on it, the ways that we could look at different fee structures, or we could look at different partnerships, as we've done so with Loyalist. And maybe there are other municipalities that may want to do the same thing with us, right? There's really nothing unneighborly about this. I think right now it's about getting information. I think what would be key is if council would indulge me, is if the information comes back and we think we want to discuss it further, then I would ask that you allow me to speak to the other mayors first so that we can have those discussions. So it's not something that we're just imposing unilaterally, but we're having those very open discussions about, we're trying to figure out how to finance those pieces. These are fair and reasonable discussions that happen all the time between municipalities. So I think that we can all agree that the spirit around this table is not in any way antagonistic. It's just about figuring out how we can do more.
In the end, most councillors were open to exploring the idea, with only councillors Glenn and McLaren opposed. City staff will report back to council with research and recommendations for implementing non-Kingston resident fees in time to be considered as part of the 2026 municipal budget process. That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is the latest Queen's Campus news updates on Campus Corner.
Good evening, folks. This is Abiyaz from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. Today in studio, we have Kara. She is the co-director of Queens Project Red, and they are organizing their annual charity fashion show on 13th and 14th February, and we will be talking to her about it. Hello, Kara. Thanks for joining us in studio today. Tell us a bit more about Project Red. What is this Project Red?
So I am Kara. I'm the co-director of Project Red this year. So Project Red is a charity fashion show. Essentially, that's our largest fundraiser. And we raise money for the Heart and Stroke Foundation. We're actually the largest student fundraising body for the Heart and Stroke Foundation in Canada. And we have been a club for 15 years. So essentially our main goal is obviously to raise money for the Heart and Stroke Foundation. And alongside that, we have a bunch of other fundraisers. We do a other fundraiser that's really big is Run Your Heart Out. That happens in October. And then throughout the year, we'll have a bunch of different fundraisers that showcase the talent that will be featured in the fashion show.
Great. So speaking of the fashion show, so what is the main goal of this year's charity fashion show?
So essentially each year, the whole point of fashion show is to sort of celebrate the creativity within the Queens community. We do a lot of collaborations with Kingston businesses that sometimes help sponsor like the fashion show. And so that's also another way to celebrate, you know, the community that we're in outside the Queens community. But essentially for this year's show, it's a tribute to the sort of childhood books that we used to read as kids. So for example, like we have a scene called like Down the Rabbit Hole, and within the show we have dances, music performances, and we have models who showcase the designs of the clothing.
That's a super interesting theme. So speaking about the participants, how do you select the designers, the models, and the performers for the event?
So because we are like an AMS club, it's all run by students. So if you want to get involved, we normally will do executive hiring in March-ish, April time. And then within the next academic year, so in September is when we'll hire like our cast members. So if you are interested in doing design, or you want to be a musician, or you want to be a model, or you want to dance, or you want to be a photographer, you want to be a videographer, whatever you want, there's a lot of different avenues you can go down. Go to Queens Project Red on the Instagram and you can find out about our hiring then, which normally happens, yes, like I said, September time.
Wonderful. So, circling back to the event, how can audiences sign up to attend this year's fashion show?
So we are selling our tickets through Eventbrite, and it's all on our link tree on our Instagram at Queens Project Red. And we also have a website, queensprojectred.ca. And also if anyone is interested in just like donating money to the charity, we have a crowd change, which goes directly straight to the Heart and Stroke Foundation.
Great. Is there any deadline to purchase the tickets?
So the show is February 13th and February 14th. And no, there is no deadline as long as we haven't sold out. It's in Grant Hall at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:15 p.m.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Kara, for taking the time to talk to us about Project Red and the upcoming fashion show. I wish you and Project Red all the best for its future endeavors, and I hope you guys have an amazing event. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye. And that's a wrap. Folks, we were talking to Kara. She is the co-director of Queens Project Red, and they are organizing a charity fashion show on 13th and 14th February. For further details, you can go to their Instagram page, Queens Project Red. You were listening to our segment, Campus Corner, and this is Abias from CFRC News. Over to Isabella for Sports After.
This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Monday, February 10th, a 60% chance of snow flurries, a daytime high of -2 with an overnight low of -11. Tuesday, February 11th, we have a daytime high of -2 with flurries throughout the day and an overnight low of -13 with a 30% chance of snow overnight. Wednesday, February 12th, it's going to be colder with a daytime high of -5, an overnight low of -9, with the possibility of snow accumulation in the 5 to 12 centimeter range by Thursday morning. Thursday, February 13th. It's going to be warmer with a daytime high of -2. Snow flurries from Wednesday night will have ceased by dawn. We're going to see an overnight low of -14, however, with heavy cloud coverage. Friday, February 14th, Valentine's Day. Daytime high of -4 with sunny conditions and an overnight low of -10. Saturday, February 15th. Daytime high of -3 with a 60% chance of flurries throughout the day and an overnight low of -10. Sunday, February 16th, daytime high of -6 with flurries throughout the day and a warmer overnight low of -3. Monday, February 17th is the coldest day of February thus far with a daytime high of -10 and an overnight low of -19. This is Jesse Bell with the City of Kingston Traffic Report for the week of February 10th, 2025. We begin with road closures. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Market Street, King to Ontario, is closed until February 21st for the Spirit of Winter. Here is a parking disruption you should be aware of. The Hanson Memorial Parking Structure Restoration Project is now underway. The work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrades to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. This work is planned to conclude in July of 2025. Lastly, here are some other delays you should be aware of. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue.
This is Henry, CFRC intern from the Queen's Department of History, bringing you this week's concert and events calendars. Starting with events on Monday, the play Big Ticket by Jim Gerard will be having its fifth performance at the Grand Theatre, with doors closing at 7:30. Tickets are available on the Grand's website. Also on Monday, both One Eye Jats and the Brass will be hosting their weekly trivia nights starting at 7 and 7:45 respectively. Later, on Tuesday, Runner's Choice will be hosting their weekly group run starting at 5:25 in Berryfield Hills. The Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square, and on Tuesday, Daft Grooming is also hosting a euchre night starting at 7 p.m. On Wednesday, the Queen's Fine Arts Silent Art Auction is being hosted at the Tet Center from 6:30 to 9 p.m. with auction tickets available online. Also on Wednesday, Musigi will be hosting its weekly life drawing event. Bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing and making new friends. Daft Brewing and Something in the Water will also be hosting their trivia nights, both starting at 7 p.m. After that, on Thursday, Daft will be hosting Drag Bingo from 7:30 to 10. The Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group has a public run starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. On Friday, which is Valentine's Day, the Grad Club will be hosting their 16th annual Slow Dance from 9 p.m. to 2. Formal wear is welcome but not required, and advance tickets are available online. This event is a two-night affair happening both on Friday and Saturday. Also on Friday, the Buttle and Daft Brewing will be hosting their free weekly karaoke nights, doors open at 9. On Saturday, Queen's PhD student Parisa Nazari will be giving a free talk on interstellar dust in Ellis Hall at 7:30 p.m. The talk is open to the public, free, and will be followed by a tour of the Queen's Observatory. The Kingston Public Market also runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. And on Sunday morning, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. And the Memorial Center Farmers Market will be taking place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Have you got an event you would like to add to our online and on-air event calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Hello again, this is still Henry Walker, CFRC intern with the Department of History, continuing with this week's concert calendar. Starting off, on Monday, Kingston Jazz and Funk Trio The Morning Dubs will be playing a free gig at Musiki at 8 p.m. Also, the Kingston Jazz Society will be hosting the Dave Barton Trio at the RCHA Club starting at 4:30. The club at the RCHA will also be hosting its weekly Tom's Tuesday Happy Hour Jam on Tuesday from 4 to 7. After that, on Wednesday, Kingston-based singer-songwriter Frank Ryan will be performing a free show at Musiki starting at 8 p.m. Also, Hotel Wolf Island will be hosting their free weekly open mic from 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. Next, on Thursday, the Mansion is putting on a four-act show featuring artists Lucas Oak, Justin Diaco, Pamela White, and the band The Honkies. There's a $5 door charge and music starts at 9. Also on Thursday, Musiki will be having Zane Pastorella in for a free show from 8 to 11 p.m. Friday night, the RCHA is having the country duo Whiskey Smokin' starting at 8 for a show. The Celtic Kitchen Party will be playing a collection of traditional and contemporary Celtic, Irish, and Scottish music at Tiernanog from 9 to 12. Also on Friday, you can catch Lisa Lehman and then Trevor Walsh at the Royal Tavern from 5 to 2 p.m. And the Gertrudes will be playing at the Toucan from 5 to 8 p.m. as well. On Saturday, Hotel Wolf Island will be hosting two five-piece bands, The Empties and The Roses, from 8:30 to 11 p.m. Kingston Group $5 Dates will be playing a gig at Tiernanog starting at 9. Also on Saturday, you can catch Juno-nominated Canadian singer-songwriter Craig Cardiff at Musiki from 3 to 5 p.m. Tickets for a show are available for around $25.57. The Mansion will also be hosting Michael Zizek and Blake Little as part of their Mansion Unplugged series from 9:30 to 11:30. Tickets are available for $11.98. On Sunday, award-winning singer Georgette Fry will be performing at the Broom Factory. Tickets are going for $32.50, with her performance starting at 2:30 p.m. And finally, the Buckle will be having Uncle Vinny playing a free gig from 6 to 9 p.m. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present the Garvin Brothers' newest single, Until We Meet Again, recorded at the Tragically Hip's Bathhouse Recording Studio by Juno Award-winning sound engineer Niles Spencer. The strong and haunting vocals capture the emotion behind losing someone you love. The song was written during a dark time of grief. The lyrics of this track serve as a comfort to anyone who's ever uttered the words, Until We Meet Again. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via Visit Kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Until We Meet Again by the Garvin Brothers on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I saw you go for the last time. I blame the disease. Could not have taken a better man from me. I blame the disease. When I saw you go, you went so slow. Sometimes I think it should have been me.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Rogue Rising's debut single, Crush, an energizing anthem of defiance and self-empowerment, driven by fiery guitar leads, a hook-laden chorus, and an unmistakable edge. Fronted by Kingston's own fearless singer, songwriter, and lead guitarist, Rowan Rogue Picard, along with Evan Kluick of Arachnia on guitar, Jason Baird of the Meringues on bass, and fellow bandmate Maddie Benoit of the Petras on drums, the single Crush was produced by five-time Juno Award winner and Glass Tiger founding member Michael Hansen. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Crush by Rogue Rising on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Should have been there. backing me. Now you are the enemy. Never trust a traitor. Lose the love and learn to hate her.
Crush
what you say you love.
Crush
what I'm dreaming of.
Crush
lightning from above.
Crush, 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 crush,
crush what you say you love.
Crush
what I'm dreaming of.
Crush
struck down from above.
Crush, 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 crush,
crush. Faces make me cry. Behind everyone's a lie. Am I living an illusion? There's no winning, no solution. Battlefronts inside my brain. Love and hate drive me insane. Put me in an institution. Maybe they'll feed my delusion.
Crush
what you say you love.
Crush
what I'm dreaming of.
Crush
lightning from above.
Crush, 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 crush,
crush what you say you love.
Crush
what I'm dreaming of.
Crush
struck down from above.
Crush, 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 crush.
Put your pain in a song. The world will sing along. Put your pain in a song. Sing along.
Crush
what you say you love.
Crush
what I'm dreaming of.
Crush
lightning from above.
Crush, 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 crush,
crush what you say you love.
Crush
what I'm dreaming of.
Crush
struck down from above.
Crush, 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 crush,
crush.
The LA Times called Mekla a network of political clout that is based on converting money and influence into political power rather than electing gays to political office.
Full political and civil equality for gay and lesbian Americans has not yet been achieved. That gay and lesbian Americans are treated as second-class citizens. Democracy can only flourish when all Americans can affirm themselves as citizens by full participation in our political process.
To This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Trump bans trans girls and women from women's school sports. Trans rights get Grammy-winning shoutouts. And gay Pac-Men score major wins in 80s U.S. politics. Those stories and more this week because you found This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Ava Davis.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 8th, 2025.
With this executive order, the war on women's sports is over. So this will effectively end the attack on female athletes at public K-12 schools and virtually all U.S. colleges and universities.
U.S. President Donald Trump is banning trans girls and women from competing in female sports at federally funded schools and universities. It's the latest blistering executive order targeting transgender people. Trump rambled on in a 30-minute February 5th pre-signing speech littered with several lies and inflammatory claims. He falsely claimed that trans athletes had won more than 3,500 victories and invaded more than 11,000 competitions. He perpetuated the lie that men are beating up, injuring, and cheating our women and our girls. The order is officially titled No Men in Women's Sports, and it was the president's so-called celebration of National Girls and Women in Sports Day. The ceremonial photo op featured dozens of girls and young women surrounding the adjudicated rapist as he signed the order. Executive orders are not law, but they are specific directives issued by the president to all federal agencies. Every one of Trump's anti-queer executive orders will almost certainly be challenged in court.
The impact of the No Men in Women's Sports executive order is already being felt, however. Within hours of Trump's signing it, the National Collegiate Athletic Association announced that it would comply. NCAA President Charlie Baker said in a press statement, "We strongly believe that clear, consistent, and uniform eligibility standards would best serve today's student athletes instead of a patchwork of conflicting state laws and court decisions. To that end, President Trump's order provides a clear national standard." Baker recently testified before a U.S. Senate panel that fewer than 10 transgender athletes among some 510,000 competitors currently participate in NCAA sports. The move prompted one member of the NCAA's Committee on Competitive Safeguards and Medical Aspects of Sports to resign. Dr. Jack Turbin told Baker in an open letter that the decision to bow to Trump does not align with medical or scientific consensus. "I cannot, in good conscience, participate in this kind of politicization of science and medicine at the expense of some of our most vulnerable student athletes."
All references to transgender people are disappearing from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website. Further fallout from Trump's executive orders that all federal agencies stop promoting gender ideology. Trans-specific information about HIV testing is gone. In fact, most educational HIV/AIDS information has vanished from the site. A banner explaining that the CDC website is being modified to comply with President Trump's executive orders is now displayed. The critical order is called Defending Women from Gender Ideology Extremism and Restoring Biological Truth to the Federal Government. It restricts the definition of gender to the binary male or female. Researchers at the nation's Atlanta, Georgia-based CDC have also been instructed to cleanse a list of specific phrases from their work product before any publication. Gender, transgender, pregnant person, pregnant people, LGBT, transsexual, non-binary, assigned male at birth, assigned female at birth, and biologically male, biologically female. In the words of GLAAD's Sarah Kate Ellis, Trump is clearly committed to censorship of any information containing or related to LGBTQ Americans and issues that we face. The queer advocacy group's president said that his pathetic attempt to diminish and remove us will again prove unsuccessful.
It's even come down to the email signatures of federal employees. Following the slew of presidential executive orders targeting transgender people, the Trump regime has ordered all federal employees to remove the pronouns from their email signatures. It's also part of the plan to restrict or eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and policies from every federal government agency. Employees are being warned that violating Trump's executive orders could result in possible disciplinary action, including termination. The pronouns ban was just the beginning. Agencies are now being ordered to review and remove all references to gender identity in programs, contracts, and grants. Trans workers can no longer use restrooms in federal facilities that match their gender identities. Democratic U.S. Representative from Delaware, Sarah McBride, is loudly condemning Trump's anti-trans attacks. She's Congress's first and only out transgender member. In her words, "From day one, the administration has taken actions that would force the outing of transgender people, stripping them of their privacy and safety. Each time the Trump administration attacks a small, vulnerable community, the ripple effects of hate echo across our society."
The first queer legal strikeback against the Trump administration's anti-LGBTQ onslaught is going to court. It's a lawsuit challenging the executive order ban on gender-affirming health care for patients younger than 19, brought by the LGBTQ advocacy group Lambda Legal, the National American Civil Liberties Union, and the ACLU of Maryland. Seven families with transgender or non-binary children are the plaintiffs, joined by PFLAG National, an organization for families and friends of LGBTQ people. They went to the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland on February 4th to ask for a preliminary and permanent injunction to stop the ban from going into effect. The lawsuit argues that Trump's anti-trans executive orders are unlawful and unconstitutional because they seek to withhold federal funds previously authorized by Congress. They also charge that the orders violate federal anti-discrimination laws. It's the first, but no doubt not the last, courtroom battlefront in the war between the incoming U.S. administration and the LGBTQ plus community. The fight has been joined.
Finally, many are calling the 67th annual Grammy Awards the queerest ever. Quite a few openly LGBTQ performers and several outspoken allies took home trophies in Los Angeles on February 2nd, and they were not quiet at the music industry's biggest celebration. Lesbian rapper and actor Queen Latifah presented veteran hitmaker Alicia Keys with a Dr. Dre Global Impact Award. Keys celebrated often unsung female producers and poked the orange elephant in the room over diversity, equity, and inclusion.
This is not the time to shut down the diversity of voices. We've seen on this stage talented, hardworking people from different backgrounds with different points of view, and it changes the game. DEI is not a threat, it's a gift.
Lesbian singer Chappelle Roan performed her chart-topping Pink Pony Club during the telecast and then won the Best New Artist Grammy. She stressed trans rights during a red carpet interview ahead of the ceremonies.
Brutal right now, but trans people have always existed and they will forever exist, and they will never, no matter what happens, take trans joy away, and that has to be protected more than anything, because I would not be here without trans girls. So just know that pop music is thinking about you and cares about you. And I'm trying my best to, like, really stand up for you.
Longtime ally Lady Gaga won the Grammy for Best Pop Duo Group Performance for Die With a Smile, which she sang with Bruno Mars. Gaga used her platform to take a strong stand for the embattled transgender and queer communities.
It is a privilege to be a songwriter and a producer, a musician. It's such an honor to sing for all of you. And I just want to say tonight that trans people are not invisible. Trans people deserve love. The queer community deserves to be lifted up. Music is love. Thank you.
That's News Wrap. Global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 8th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazor, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V. Stay healthy.
And I'm Ava Davis. Stay safe.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
LGBTQ people for political gain is nothing new. The first major confrontation between queer and conservative powerhouses in the U.S. was four decades ago. The aggressive culture war launched by pop singer Anita Bryant and televangelist Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority. There are lessons in strategy to learn from those difficult days. In addition to the street activism of the 70s, checkbook activism became a thing, and the country's first official LGBTQ political action committee was born. This Way Out's David Hunt tells the story of that organization's rise to prominence.
You've probably never heard of MECLA, the Municipal Elections Committee of Los Angeles. But in its heyday in the 1980s, it was a political powerhouse, raising large sums of money and using it to reward local, state, and national politicians whose interests aligned, at least some of the time, with its own. MECLA was a special interest, the first political action committee organized to advance the cause of gays and lesbians in the United States. This at a time when gays were largely closeted, and for good reason. Legally, they were outlaws, socially outcasts, and politically outmatched and outspent by the New Right, a broad coalition of Christian fundamentalists and social conservatives. With the rise of MECLA, gays and lesbians wielded a new tool in the fight for equality, what a California politician once called the mother's milk of politics, money. Join me now for a deep dive into the rise and fall of MECLA, a queer story of power politics in the Reagan era. I'm David Hunt. It's April 23rd, 1983. David Bowie's Let's Dance is moving up the music charts in the United States. And that's exactly what the crowd at the Hollywood Palladium has on its mind this evening. They've turned out in black tie, tuxes, and designer gowns, and shelled out $175 apiece to drink, dine, and dance in the Palladium's Art Deco ballroom. But before they can show off their moves on the dance floor, attendees turn their attention to the guest of honor, who just happens to be a leading candidate for president.
Now, I may be naive, but I believe any candidate for the presidency should welcome the opportunity to speak to any group of Americans who believe in the first principles of this country: equality and justice, freedom of speech and freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and freedom of expression.
Gary Hart, a U.S. Senator from Colorado, is anything but naive. He's an Atari Democrat, numbered among a group of young, tech-savvy lawmakers who champion computer technologies, like the semiconductor chips used in Atari game consoles. He's a veteran campaigner as well, the man who spearheaded Democrat George McGovern's 1972 presidential run. His own run for the White House is just getting started. The first primary in New Hampshire, still 9 months off. To build momentum in a crowded field, Hart needs money and visibility. The sponsor of the event at the Hollywood Palladium, MECLA, has plenty of cash. It will spend upwards of $300,000 in 1983 to support candidates, like Hart, who support gay rights. But Hart's support comes at a price in the form of negative publicity. A national syndicated columnist rages against the senator for daring to legitimize what has been a marginalized minority. When self-described Christian Gary Hart steps to the podium at the Hollywood Palladium on April 23rd to make common cause with a group of homosexual rights advocates and their supporters, the columnist wrote, "This will be a spectacle so bizarre that even Warner Brothers could not have envisioned it." But Hart is short on money. There are rumors that his campaign is failing to meet payroll. So he turns to Hollywood homosexuals no less, to boost his campaign coffers. And Hart, who has a degree in divinity from Yale, isn't about to let his political opponents smear his faith.
"The criticism made against me by this columnist is that I'm not a true Christian if I attend this dinner. Let me give you my, at least partial, definition of what I believe Christianity, for that matter Judaism, to include. It's a love of God, it's a love, tolerance, and respect for others as for ourselves, and it includes the admonition, judge not, lest ye be judged also. Now, this attack for making this one speech suggests how difficult the daily life of every gay and lesbian American must be. If I'm attacked for one speech, you're under attack every day. It suggests that you are under constant siege from narrow-minded, judgmental zealots of the right. It suggests the forces of the right are unceasing and denying you your full rights as American citizens to make a living, secure your safety, and protect your health. It suggests something I feel very strongly, that full political and civil equality for gay and lesbian Americans has not yet been achieved, that gay and lesbian Americans are treated as second-class citizens. Democracy can only flourish when all Americans can affirm themselves as citizens by full participation in our political process.
This full-throated endorsement of gays and lesbians was something new in American politics. When nine gay men launched MECLA 6 years earlier, in 1977, the political landscape was much different and far less welcoming for an emerging interest group with little public support and no record of success in electoral politics. Industry groups, labor unions, blacks, even women could deliver votes and dollars to friendly candidates. Gays couldn't even get politicians to take their money. In a 1983 interview with the Los Angeles Times, MECLA board member Steve Smith recalled, "Politicians were reluctant to go on the record as receiving contributions labeled gay money. We had to go around begging people to take money from us in the beginning." In 1977, America's age-old conflict between conservatives and liberals was heating up again. Conservatives had lost political ground after the Watergate scandal toppled President Richard Nixon and brought a Southern peanut farmer and Sunday school teacher, Jimmy Carter, to the White House. Republicans were eager to retake the moral high ground. Battle lines were soon drawn, and gays and lesbians were at the very center of the battle. In California, State Senator John Briggs decided that a crusade against gay teachers would energize his run for California governor. Since Democrats controlled both houses of the legislature, Briggs opted to go straight to the voters, collecting enough signatures to place Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative, on the statewide ballot in the November 1978 general election. The proposed law would have barred gays and lesbians, and even their allies, from working as teachers, classroom aides, or school counselors. MECLA, little more than a year old, jumped into the fight feet first. You're listening to This Way Out, the International LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt, continuing my look at MECLA, the Municipal Elections Committee of Los Angeles. With the battle over the Briggs Initiative, a California ballot measure that would have barred gays and lesbians from teaching in public schools, the culture wars were off to a rousing start. The campaign galvanized gays and lesbians in California and elsewhere, who rallied to the call, out of the closets and into the streets. David Mixner, one of the founders of MECLA and head of the No on Six campaign, put his political skills to work, eventually helping to line up leading conservative politicians, including former California Governor Ronald Reagan, against the Briggs Initiative. It was a brilliant strategy, casting the measure as government overreach, the nanny state on steroids. The Briggs Initiative wasn't just voted down, it was crushed, opposed by 58% of voters, losing even in conservative Orange County, California, birthplace of Richard Nixon and a GOP stronghold since 1896. The come-from-behind victory against the Briggs Initiative put David Mixner and MECLA in a new light. Nothing succeeds like success, as they say, and America's first gay and lesbian political action committee had a success story like no other. While the gay and lesbian movement might be struggling across the country, in California, it was a force to be reckoned with. After Briggs, politicians no longer turned away Mekla's gay money. In fact, they clamored for the chance to attend the group's events and to tout their pro-gay and feminist credentials to Mekla's influential and affluent members. Mekla began holding monthly breakfast meetings at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, featuring local, state, and even national politicians. And its annual dinner drew a who's who of elected officials, mostly Democrats, eager to stand with a new brand of rich and respectable gays and lesbians. The Reverend Troy Perry, a longtime gay activist and founder of the Metropolitan Community Churches, captured the spirit of the times. "It's out of the closets and into the Beverly Wilshire," he quipped. Mekla's demands were relatively modest. Board member Peter Scott told the Los Angeles Times in 1978, "We're not asking for any special treatment. We're just asking to be allowed to express affection like any heterosexual would, without fear of losing our livelihoods." Mekla, the Times reported in 1979, does not publicly endorse candidates or lobby for legislation as its principal activity. It simply gives money to candidates who, in the group's words, are supportive of human rights in general and gay rights in particular. In March 1979, 600 gays and lesbians paid $100 a plate to mingle with California's political power structure. The dinner's sponsors included Governor Jerry Brown, Senator Alan Cranston, Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley, 9 congressmen, 20 state legislators, and 9 members of the Los Angeles City Council. Assembly Speaker Leo McCarthy, who delivered the keynote address, marveled at Mekla's growing political influence. He called Mekla a sophisticated money-giving group that is making gay activism not only politically respectable, but politically powerful as well. LA Times reporter Doyle McManus, who attended the dinner, noted that thanks to Mekla, office seekers no longer viewed gay support as the kiss of death for their campaigns. "Powerful? You bet they're powerful," one politician confided to McManus. "We pay attention, I can tell you that." What followed was Mekla's golden age. Even as the Reagan Revolution swept America, turning the country to the right, Mekla thrived. In 1981, its annual dinner raised $100,000 in a single evening. The LA Times called Mekla a network of political clout that is based on converting money and influence into political power, rather than electing gays to political office. It was called checkbook activism, a clean, quiet alternative to street activism. "Let gays and lesbians in San Francisco or New York chant catchy slogans under a rainbow banner. LA gays and lesbians let their money do the talking." Green was the color most politicians took notice of. Mekla offered Democrats a friendly forum to defend liberal policies that were increasingly under attack by the Republican Reagan administration, and to flip the script and attack Reagan's economic agenda.
"I view the Reagan presidency as one of the great tragedies of the 20th century."
Tom Hayden, an anti-war activist who had helped organize protests outside the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, moved inside the Democratic Party establishment in the 1970s. In 1982, he addressed Mekla as a candidate for the California Assembly, a post he would win with Mekla's help. Jerry Brown, running for the U.S. Senate after 2 terms as California's governor, received a warm welcome at a Mekla breakfast meeting at the Beverly Wilshire in the spring of 1982. Brown blasted the Reagan administration's budget cuts, which had left states like California struggling to fill gaps in social services.
"What we have is a redistribution of wealth from the very poorest people and the people who are working at the bottom of the income cycle to those at the highest income level. Now, that was supposed to produce this high level of affluence for everyone. And what it has done has not improved the economy and is tearing apart the social fabric."
Next week, I'll examine the limits of Mekla's influence and follow the organization's slow decline and demise in the midst of a global pandemic. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.